Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you all very much for a very wonderful welcome. And you know, I might say about Ivy Baker Priest as treasurer that just among one of the many things that she has done since taking office, she has the investing of some of our special trust funds. And she had $18 million less to invest than her predecessor had the year before. But with $18 million less, she has returned on that investment $67 million in earnings, which is $11 million more than her predecessor did with a greater amount of money. But to show you, I'm stealing a line now. The thing she's proudest of is that $67 million is 131 times as much as it costs to run her department. She figured that out between investments. Well, Madam Presidents, members of our state and our national committee, ladies and gentlemen, is this really where Bobby Kennedy stood? You know, when he came to California, that was the only easy moment that Lyndon's had. I understand the president is so nervous that before the Democratic convention next summer, he's going to put the country in his wife's name. You know, this is the season, of course, with an election year coming up. When we talk about issues and everything, I've got to tell you a little story. It has nothing to do with anything I'm going to say. But just to show you how far afield people can get when they start talking issues, it's a story that Jim Rhodes of Ohio told me about Ross Barnett, the former governor of Mississippi. He said Ross was vacationing in Florida. He was sitting on the beach with a friend, and he was going on about the federal government. And he said, do you know that he's those fellas in foreign aid? He says they've actually spent $27.5 million of the American people's money buying oil heating equipment for natives that live in tents in the hottest part of the Sahara Desert. And his friend said, Ross, you really know that to be true for a fact? And he says, no, but it's a hell of an issue in Mississippi. Well, this is the first time we've been able to get together in a long time. Since the last time I saw you, a funny thing happened to me on the way to Death Valley. But I'll tell you, it is a pleasure to be here, seriously, with you who have supported and worked hard for the principles in which we believe and the candidates who represent them. Your work, your support has given you and the members of the other Republican volunteer groups have made it possible, I should say, the victory of last November. I'm grateful, and I know that many who are winners and losers on our side also are grateful for the help that they received from you. Now, this election put California on the right road. In the interest of harmony, let me hasten to say I use right in the sense of being correct. But it's not a road back, but it's a road ahead to a better and a more responsible and a more meaningful life for all our citizens. A life which allows us to develop and pursue our aims and ambitions to the fullest without the constant interference and domination by those in government, whether elected or appointed. But we've just started down that road, and there's a great deal that remains to be done, and many pitfalls lie ahead. As a matter of fact, sometimes I think I've been living in one of those pitfalls for the last 9 months. Nancy says it beats living in the mansion. But during these 9 months, we have sought to implement a philosophy of government that was expressed during the campaign and which was evidently approved by the majority of our citizens. We did promise to try and reduce the size of government, to make government more efficient, to introduce common sense in some of our vexing problems. We promised to make appointments on the basis of those who were qualified for the job, and indeed to seek those who had no political ambition but were willing to dedicate a part of their lives in public service. We told you that we thought it was essential to put this state on a sound fiscal basis so we could get on with the legitimate business of government free of the constant threat of insolvency. And last, we told you that we didn't believe any one of us who were asking for your votes, or that we together could run government by ourselves, or that government could afford enough manpower to make all the decisions for all of our 20 million people in this state. Told you that we'd turn to the people, for our greatness as a state is dependent on the genius and the ability of our people. This is the first opportunity I've had to offer you a kind of resume. And since I believe it's the right of the people to know, I welcome a chance to tell you some of our trials and troubles and our triumphs. Now, during the campaign, we did our best to poke some holes in the wrapping and discover what was in the box that might be ours in the following January. And January finally came, and we were able to untie the package and take a good look. And a lot of us were tempted to put some scotch tape on it and mark it return to sender. We found that the state was spending each year $400 million more than the revenue for the state in a year. We found that in the 4 years from 1962 to 66, the number of welfare recipients in California had increased in just that 4 year period by 54.6%. We discovered that each year, for the last several years, the number of state employees had increased from 4 to 5%, and we now had 166,000 of them. Budgets, which normally should reflect the increase in population plus the increased costs of supplies and services due to inflation, this should be an annual increase of about 8%, but they were almost doubling that. We found that there was little or no centralized buying. No one even knew in this state government how many automobiles the state of California owned. Now, most departments, we discovered, were out on their own buying retail. There was no proper use of competitive bidding or standardization of specifications. Now, I don't say this as a reflection on the quality of state employees. We have good ones. But they'd worked for a long time under a philosophy that government placed no premium on the value of tried and true business practices. Between November and January, as we set out to keep some of the promises, we formed two committees, one north and one south. And they were to go out recruiting. They sought the people who had been successful, people who didn't aspire for government service but could be persuaded to do a hitch for a time at least in community service. And I think today that it's safe to say that the results of their recruiting, of citizens going out, of citizens buttonholing corporation presidents and so forth and saying, look, you have a fellow we could use. Why don't you tell him he's free to take this job for a couple of years or so, and then you guarantee you'll take him back, make him available. And today we have in most of our administrative positions people, many of them young men, who still have their mark to make in the world, but who gave up tremendous incomes to take a far lesser salary and work for government because they believed in what we were trying to do. And I think that in that regard, in the administrative appointees, the department and agency heads, we have the finest personnel that any state has ever been able to boast in this country. During that same 2-month period, we were working with our Republican legislators. We were putting together a legislative program covering every one of the campaign promises. We looked for every possible way to reduce the deficit that would be ours at the end of the fiscal year, which in January was just less than 6 months ahead of us. Now, incidentally, while that was going on, we only had 2 weeks to submit a budget that would be due in that next 6 months, or would start operating in that next 6 months for this present fiscal year. And with the budget we'd inherited, the deficit we'd inherited, the new budget that was laid there waiting for us, it was a little bit like trying to pat your head and rub your tummy at the same time. There was one day when there were a lot of papers on my desk and there were a lot of fellas around telling me the newest things they'd discovered, and I found myself shuffling through the papers. I figured there must be a letter of resignation in there someplace. And then somebody said to me, cheer up, things could be worse. So I cheered up, and sure enough, they got worse. But anyway, we started whittling. Orders were coming in from various departments for new cars, everything from Buick Rivieras to Pontiacs with bucket seats. So we put a freeze on all the new purchases until we could find out how and why they were being ordered. The cry of anguish was pitiful to hear. It's awful to hear grown men cry. So were their predictions of doom. Maybe you remember reading, we were going to return to the horse. Well, in 3 months, we reported for the first time, I think, in the history of the automobile in California, there was a surplus of automobiles in the state motor pools over and above the demand by employees for those cars. And by May 1st, the state was buying 15% less gasoline. We put a freeze on out-of-state travel. And to date, 9 months later, we have reduced the budget for out-of-state travel by 78%. Our state has a $16 million phone bill. And like with the automobiles, it was because the phones had just been ordered on a basis of everyone to his own taste. We found employees sitting at adjacent desks, end to end, and they had intercommunicating systems on their phones to call each other. In fact, we found some didn't know they had that on the phone, even though it was costing us. It added $2 to the cost of each phone a month, and somebody hit one of the buzzers, and the person at the desk said, what was that? Well, anyway, we found they even had signal lights on the phone, sitting right beside each other, so this one could look at the light and tell whether the one beside him was using the phone. And we took some of those things out. We have now received in writing from the telephone company the information. Well, perhaps I should tell you what we did, how we arrived at this. It seemed a little reasonable to us that in some of these instances, the people ought to just be able to turn their heads and see whether someone else was using the phone. Now, you know, and I know, that the phone company offers as a regular service people who will come in and you tell them your telephone needs and they'll survey and find out what's the most efficient and the most economical phone system for you to have to fulfill your needs? But no one in government seemed to have known that. So we asked the phone company to come in. One opposing legislator immediately rushed to the microphone to charge us with conflict of interest. Well, if there was a conflict of interest in the part of the phone company, it's a conflict of interest we could afford, because we have just received in writing from the phone company the results of their study, and the phone bill will be $2 million a year less. Now, there was another thing we found in the office. There was one thing our opponents were optimistic. There was a stack of stationery that high had the other fellow's name on it. And the janitors came in one day with the wheel dollies to cart that out and burn it. And I couldn't stand it. Wait a minute. I got some stationery with my name on it, but we figured there must be a lot of interdepartmental stuff where we could use that up. So the girls have just been X-ing out that one name and typing mine in. And you know I get a certain amount of pleasure out of that. But our biggest interest lay in that 4 to 5% increase in the number of employees each year. There was one way to find out if they were essential, all of them, to efficient government. So So we knew there was an annual turnover. Employees who retired, resigned, took other jobs. So we put a freeze on hiring any replacements for anyone who left state service to find out how far we could shrink it down before the cracks began to appear in the efficient running of government. We not only, in 9 months, have stopped that regular increase of 4 or 5% a year, but tonight, I can tell you we are 2.5% fewer employees than there were when we took office last January. We turned to the people as we said we would. There's a man, an industrialist in Los Angeles, who did a fantastic job of public service in gathering together the industrialists in the Los Angeles area 2 years ago. And he made them recognize that the job of private enterprise is to provide jobs. And they have gone in on a voluntary basis, working in conjunction with the state employment office, into the minority areas, the poverty pockets of our state, to provide jobs in private enterprise. In the 2 months between November and January, we went to Chad McClellan and asked him if he would take this on a statewide basis. He not only is doing it, but he and his associates have raised the money to finance the operation. And today, the industrialists of California are mobilized, some 1,500 here in the Bay Area, 2,600 in Los Angeles, I don't know how many hundred in San Diego, down through the valley in all of our leading cities. And they have been regularly seeking out the unemployed with only one task. They haven't been saying a word about the numbers, saying nothing of what they're accomplishing. They are simply seeking to match the unemployed with jobs they can do or be trained to do. And I know that when the day comes to tote up the score, we'll find that a great many thousands, just as we found in that 1-2 year instance in Los Angeles, have been put to work. Bob Finch has taken on the chore of representing our state government, working closely and in liaison with Chad McClellan in this job, full-time job that he's doing. Then we went to the leading citizens of this state, the most successful men and women of the state in industry, the professions, and business. They ranged all the way from data processing to restaurant and hotel men. And we got them together in a room, and we told them what we had in mind. We think it was kind of revolutionary. We told these very successful men that for years now, they've been going into the locker room after a golf game, and usually the subject would get around to politics and government and why can't government be run somewhat on the same efficient business lines as private business. And we said, here's your chance. We're not asking you to sit on a committee. We're not asking you to just contribute something. We want you. We want you to volunteer to give the next 4 to 6 months of your time, full time, 5 day week, away from your homes, going into every agency and department of our state government to come back and tell us how these agencies and departments can be made more efficient by instituting common, ordinary business practices. They've just completed their 6 months of this. As I say, we are compiling now, correlating their reports, their recommendations, and we'll see the results in the months ahead. One sample that I could give you, because it's already been put into effect, one of those task forces that was organized started by applying the same standards for apportioning floor space, office space per employee that would be used in private business. And as a result of what they found, because this had never been done in government, we were able this summer to cancel the construction of a $4,300,000 10-story building that they were able to prove will not be needed now or in the foreseeable future. They went over to a 14-story building, which is already up under construction. They're working on the interior now in Sacramento. And we now found by applying the same standards that work every day in business, we're going to put 1,051 more people in that building than had originally been planned for. The state presently occupies 9 million square feet of office space in California. Under their recommendations and in the coming year, we expect to reduce that to 7 million square feet of office space. Now, there were some who reacted in shocked horror as we proceeded to do some of the things we'd promised in the campaign, even though some of these same people seemingly approved them. And we learned the savage anger with which some in state government can fight back and actually sabotage our efforts at reducing the size and power of government. And as they got their propaganda mill grinding, I'm sure that you must be confused and lack the answers, particularly when someone of a different political philosophy challenges you for an answer to some of the things that seem to be going on. Well, let me tell you, sometimes I'm confused when I read what I'm supposedly doing. Now, for the most part, the press has been very fair and objective. But here and there, there are a few publications that let their ideology get in the way of their objectivity. And I can read what they say I'm doing and get so mad at myself that I rush out and sign a recall petition. Now, there's only one way to avoid being controversial, and that's to do nothing. There was, for example, and still is, the matter of tuition. Now, I have no quarrel with those who choose to disagree with me, either on philosophical grounds or on the practical virtues or the lack of same with regard to this subject. But I do suggest that there's been a considerable distortion of what we advocated and a great deal of silence about the details of the program that we offered. And frankly, I, for one, am fed up with hearing a debate on the merits of free education versus the other kind. Because the proper area for the debate is that education is very costly, and the debate is who should pay and what share should those bear who are getting the benefit from that education. And since no one in the academic community has seen fit to mention the plan that we proposed and the reasons back of it, I'd like to do so briefly right here and now. You at least ought to know what we've been talking about. Our great university system offers a top-grade premium education for the top 12.5% scholastically rated in their high school classes. Now, since a little effort has been made to make this education available to those in the lower income groups, since entrance is based completely on scholastic attainment, we find that those attending the university come from families in the same relative economic brackets as do the students who are attending the private and independent colleges and universities such as Stanford and USC and Pomona, Santa Clara, and the rest. Now, problem number one in the state university is education for the students from the lower income families. Problem number two is a high dropout rate, which isn't talked about very much, an excessively high dropout rate in our great university system. Problem number three are students who are terribly disturbed because they read in the catalog about eminent professors, but they don't see them because the professors aren't teaching, they're engaged in research. And problem number four is that to keep our university expanding and growing to meet our increasing population, there are never enough state funds. And so after you've paid for the necessary growth, you find that you run into the only thing that you have to stop or that you can't afford are the new programs, the new courses, the new teaching chairs. Well, we suggested a tuition that's just one-sixth of the tuition charged at USC. It's less than one-tenth of what it costs the state to educate the student. We were asking them to bear a 10% of the cost. If this plan had been accepted, half of the money would have been used to provide, or would be if they will still adopt this plan, in a combination of grants and loans for needy students, with the grant each year getting larger and the loan getting smaller, so that by the senior year, to go on and get their diploma instead of dropping out, the encouragement is the total amount is a grant. Taking the balance of the money from this modest charge, half of it would pay for 250 new teaching chairs at the state universities, with salaried professors with $25,000 each for a salary to provide a teacher or a professor who would teach and be in contact with the students. And this would leave several million dollars for capital building projects each year on the campuses to help keep pace with the rapid growth that is so necessary. Now, apparently, all these suggestions and this system proves that I am against youth, education, and intellectualism. So let me add something that I'm for in connection with this same kind of program and that I believe all Republicans should be for. Legislation that is now hung up on a committee, in a committee in Congress, that would grant a full tax credit to parents who are paying tuition for their sons and daughters to go to school. Has anyone ever thought how this would expand the ability of the private sector of the economy to help in education, as they cannot do now on a deductible basis even? Businessmen and concerns could go down and pick the needy student who needs help and pay his tuition to go to school, and it would be a tax credit. Now, I'm sure that many of you in the recent months have been disturbed over the charges that the administration is practicing economy at the expense of the mentally ill. Several days ago, I read while I was in Los Angeles, a very melodramatic account in the paper of the deteriorating care for mental patients, and even how one might have been saved from suicide if more care had been available. They very carefully refrained from making it clear that the suicide occurred the year before I took office. Now, very simply, we have been continuing a policy that in recent years put California out in front in the nation on the basis of mental health care. From 1960 to July of 1966, the number of patients in our mental hospitals declined by more than 10,000. In that same six-year period, the number of employees in those hospitals increased by more than 1,000. We decided to maintain the ratio of patient to employee that was in effect a year ago, July, at the beginning of the last fiscal year. At the same time, we would seek to upgrade the program of local care, which was responsible for this decline in the patients in the hospitals in the first place. This was what put California out in front, a system of diagnostic treatment and quick care in the hospital, and then a return of those patients who could be returned to local health care centers, partially financed by the state and by the counties, where they could live in their own surroundings. And this was all been made possible in part by the great development of the tranquilizer drugs in recent years. It's a proven success. And so I can tell you that the result of all of our terrible program of reduction of mental health care, supposedly, if we're to believe the charges, can be summed up in the report a few days ago, and I haven't seen much mileage on this, of the National Association for State Mental Health Groups, which revealed that our increased support for local programs this year is the largest such increase in history, and where a year ago we were spending $13.38 per day on each patient, we are now spending in excess of $15 a day per patient, and we are still out in front of the rest of the nation. And we are going to stimulate this to the very limit that this local health care program can possibly handle the problem. Now, within the last 2 days, San Franciscans have been treated kind of an old-fashioned sob-sister account of the inhumanities that are being practiced in our efforts to bring order out of chaos in the Medi-Cal program. According to a front-page account, senior citizens are being callously moved from familiar surroundings to the cold loneliness among strangers, all as the result of our cuts. Well, in the first place, the program always provided that the care for acute treatment facilities was limited time-wise and would be followed by transferring the patients into nursing homes. Now, it's true that what is taking place and did take place with some patients here was an intermediate move pending the availability of rooms in nursing homes. But this was made necessary because under this program now there's a great shortage of hospital beds. The story further implied that there was a kind of penny-wise and pound-foolishness in what we were doing, hinting that the hospital that we were moving the patients to here in San Francisco was more expensive per bed than the one they were leaving. And that's true. But the story didn't point out that the expense in the hospital they were moved to went on for the state, whether the beds were occupied or not, because the state is paying the hospital so much per bed, whether that bed has an occupant or not. So we actually were spending the money anyway and could make a savings in making the move that we did. Now, nor did the story make it clear that no patient can be moved if there is medical opinion that the patient's health would be adversely affected. And everyone who's working in this program has been told that we expect them to observe that, and when the doctor says the patient stays, the patient stays. Now, the same writer previously wrote some days ago and quoted a rumor that we were canceling natal care for economy in our Medi-Cal cuts, even though before that story appeared in print or was written, that same writer had come to us in Sacramento and asked if this rumor was true and had been told there was absolutely no foundation for the rumor whatsoever, that Medi-Cal was providing natal care. Now, as I said earlier, the budget should increase about 8% a year if there are no new programs. Our taxes are so geared to the economy that the revenue of the state increases about 8% a year to keep pace with this growth. Now, if the people think of a new program, a new service that they believe government should afford them, the people can weigh the cost of that new service and its desirability against a new tax program that would be required because this would raise the budget above the 8%. If the answer is no, there's no need for an increase in taxes. But hastily put together, in a 12th hour, the Medi-Cal program of California is increasing at a rate of 50% a year. And unless it's reformed, it will require an annual tax increase every year and eventually bankrupt the state. The increase this year over last is $100 million. Projecting ahead to next year's budget, we can already see the increase will be $145 million. For the year following, it'll be in excess of $200 million, and so on in a kind of geometric progression. Now, incidentally, all of welfare in California is increasing several times more than the 8%, and so is the cost of higher education. In the meantime, over and above Medi-Cal's built-in escalation, we discovered by taking a complete inventory of all 58 counties that there was a long pipeline filled with unpaid bills from the previous year. And there's no provision in the present budget for this newly discovered deficit. Now, our opponents have been making much of the fact that estimates of this deficit vary from $210 million to $130 million, the inference being that we might not be telling the truth or we don't know what we're talking about. Well, we're telling the truth, but it's also true we really don't know how much the deficit is, because this is a little bit like guessing how many beans there are in a jar. We all know that the program has to be cut, or we're in deficit spending. Now, we have cut the program by shutting off some of the programs. We figured that people can live without reading glasses, perhaps for a time, or podiatry, or braces on their teeth, or dentures. Now, this doesn't mean we don't think those things are important. We just don't think they're as equally important as a life-saving operation. But we had people rise up and say, oh, the only way to do this is across the board, make all the cuts proportionate in every part of the program. And it sounds pretty good. Seems to make sense, doesn't it? Until you stop to think that over here on this side are some people needing braces on their teeth. And over here are some people needing cancer operations. And if you're going to make sure that somebody gets braces on their teeth, somebody over here doesn't get an operation for cancer. And it doesn't make much sense when you picture it that way. There has to be some kind of priority. Now, the answer to this problem lies in legislation. The legislation that we must ask from a Democratic majority in an election year. It's only reasonable to assume that they'll have at least one eye on the value of politically keeping a Republican administration from looking too good in 1968. All the economies we've made and will make are in the 20%, the mere one-fifth of the budget that we can affect by executive order. The other 80% is fixed by statute, and we really can't reduce that excessive cost of government until we can change the law. Now, there were a number of things we couldn't get this year. We couldn't get the secret ballot that we tried to get for labor union members within their unions. It's buried in committee. We couldn't get the anti-pornography bill to protect our children from the spread of pornography. It's buried in committee. We believe in a two-term limitation on governors, and we couldn't get that. We believe in taking the judges out of politics, tax reform, restructuring the cancerous growth of welfare. All of these things must be done by way of the legislature. It took those who built this Leviathan-type government we're confronted with 35 years. So don't get discouraged if we don't reverse the whole trend in one session of the legislature or two. Next January, we'll still be outnumbered in the house that Daddy built by 4 votes. Now, Bob Finch gives us the one vote majority in the Senate any time that our Republicans will stick together and create the 2020 tie. And how did that happen? Well, because some weeks ago, those of you who live here and many of you who live in far ends of the state came together in this city from all over the state to support a Republican candidate in a special election. And you didn't stop to ask, was he liberal or moderate or conservative? He was a Republican candidate. You put yourselves up at your own expense. You walked the precincts. You appeared again on election day as a victory squad to get out the vote. And we couldn't have won then and been within shooting range now of control of the Senate, the designation of the committees, and the naming of the chairman without you. We couldn't have won in 66, and we won't win in 68 without the wholehearted and the undivided support of all of you. Now, after 68, there are 2 more years to go. Think what can be done in those 2 years if we have not only an administration, but we have a majority in the 2 houses over in Sacramento. Even in the meantime, we must stand together if we're going to broaden the base of our party, because you can have an influence on those who place partisanship above public good. And we can see that those who invoke partisanship will have to defend their position before the people, because we will let the people know. Last November, millions of people throughout this country voted for a change, at least for a pause, a chance to review and take inventory of the plans of those in power in this country. They didn't just decide to change hats and join another club for a while. Now, fortunately, for those concerned millions, we also paused to take inventory. We discovered as Republicans that we could no longer afford the luxury of internal fighting and backbiting and throat cutting. We discovered that our philosophy differed from those presently in power and differed a great deal greater than any grudge that we might have or any split within our own ranks. And we were ready and in position to offer an alternative to these concerned citizens who wanted to join others not just to win a political contest, but to preserve a way of life. We can't offer them any narrow sectarian party in which all must swear to a unanimity of thought. Such a party doesn't win elections. It just leaves the stage of history in a blaze of glorious defeat, and it never puts into practice the basic tenets, no matter how noble they are. Now, understand, of course, I'm not, when I talk unity, suggesting a compromise of principles or that we try to be all things to all people. Or that we're guided by political expediency. Those presently in power in Washington are already masters of that technique, and there's no sense in trying to match them. But we must be true to our belief of government created by we the people, that it exists for the convenience of the people, and that the citizens don't earn to support government, but they support government in order to be free to earn and to have some decision as to who and how their money will be spent. And because there can be no freedom without law and order, we approve acts that make freedom more secure, and we recommend disapproving any act if it offers security in exchange for freedom. In our tent, there's room for many arguments and divisions over method, approach, and even over candidates, and seldom will we ever know unanimous approval. But to prevail, we must pledge our unified support once the ultimate decision has been made, whether it's with regard to issue or candidate. And I challenge you not to further divide, but to lead the way to unity. Neither privilege or duty has allowed us to tear the fabric of the party structure apart. We can advance our own brand of sectarianism, our own candidates, but we must always remain in a position to effectively support the candidates and the issues once it is decided which ones reflect the party decision. Our 11th commandment is more profound than we realize. Thou shalt speak no ill of a fellow Republican, because to do so lessens our ability to serve the cause. No opponent should ever be able to quote the words of another Republican in an attack on our party's nominee. Now, I don't believe that I have a right to get involved in a primary, but I do think I have an obligation to support every nominee of the party. You, on the other hand, should be involved. Your membership in this organization proves that you're the activists in the party, but you must also be the leaders in setting campaign standards, ready to support, but also ready to repudiate those who fail to live up to those standards. Just a year ago, we were a party almost totally without party, and the two-party system existed only in memory or in theory. Out of sheer necessity, we achieved unity and victory. And with that victory, we bought time. Time to rally our forces for what may be our last chance. I've never been one to put my head in the lion's mouth, but maybe in the next few minutes, I'm going to come close enough to feel his breath. I wish I could tell you what it's like day after day in Sacramento, not only for myself, for all our other constitutional officers, and for our legislators, to try to put together, to program legislation, things that we believe you've asked for and that you want, but to know the impossibility if our opponents decide, for partisan political reasons, to invoke party discipline, to know that it'll just go into a committee and that's that, and you won't even hear it discussed or debated. I wouldn't be so presumptuous as to inject myself into your internal affairs, but we can't win in the next election without your help. And you can't help us win unless you are prepared to place your responsibility to the challenge and the opportunity that confronts us above any of your organizational differences. We can't broaden the base of the party if those who are looking for the leadership in this party, and they are looking for that leadership all over this country. I just came back from one of the most exciting experiences in South Carolina, of all places, to see 3,500 South Carolinians at $100 a plate for those who ate on the main floor, standing room only, in a room cheering under the sign of the elephant for a Republican victory. And on to... These people are looking for something. went on to Milwaukee, and there were more than 6,000. They raised $300,000 at the one affair for the party battles ahead. But let me tell you again about us in Sacramento and what we think is going on. We started something here, yes, and we're pretty proud of it. There's a new kind of tourist been visiting California lately. He's turning up in Sacramento. He's come to see what's going on. And what's going on is government of the people. Now, we're being watched by these people all over the country. I think the responsibility is greater here in California than any place else. There are people all over this country that have taken a renewed hope that the American dream has been restored. And you're going to have a great bearing on that. You were the group in the 66 election who set the standard. You were the ones in all of our party who had the courage to say to every one of us who was running, you obey the 11th commandment or we don't support you. And you had a great deal to do with the unity of this party that came together in the great victory in 66. Now what you do here in this particular convention is going to have an influence far beyond these borders. There are still wounds out in the country in our party, easily reopened if they're not open already. And you can go a long way to assuming a position of national leadership if you here will resolve when you leave here that whatever decision has been reached, you are unified in support of the party and you are not going to vitiate or divide the strength of this great organization for the battle to come. This time, in 68, and I have never felt more deeply the importance of an election or believed so much that it is virtually last chance. This time, we either light a torch for all of America, or we're going to be tasting the ashes of dead dreams and lost hopes for the rest of our lives.